It's time to clip your last good piece and dig in, because the runout starts now.
I was kind of like poking fun at all of these responses I was getting about Dave Flash and all the people who believed that they in their career were the ones who invented it. And someone, you know, was just like, you're being mean. Why are you being so mean to these people? Stop bullying and blah, blah, blah. And it's like, I don't know. I mean, I was just like, I mean, that's why I wrote that ridiculous, like apology, like non-apology, apology spoof thing, which, you know, people loved. And, but it was just, I don't know, there's this sense that any poking of fun at anything was just going to, is bullying. Like, that's a word that has a loaded concept to it, you know, and especially in light of like climbing history, you know, like one of my best friends who we didn't need not name, you know, basically lost all of his professional opportunities over charges of bullying and whatever. Those details we can litigate on another conversation, but just to, all I'm just saying is that when someone comes at you and you're obviously just like poking fun at something so non-consequential and like charge, you know, accuses you of bullying, it just left this really like kind of bitter taste in my mouth. So that's why I wrote that ridiculous thing.
Well, and also it reduces that idea of bullying to nothing.
Yeah, it's just meaningless.
And bullying is a serious charge, and it's real, and there's consequences to it. But I mean, it goes back to like, you know, our constant thing about there being a lack of humor,
yeah,
and this loss of this kind of regime of sort of the, as the Brits say, taking the piss, which was, it was and continues to be such a fundamental part of climbing, because climbing is dumb. Mm-hmm. And like the fact that you climb a boulder up the hard way and you spend months trying to do that is dumb. It's fucking stupid. Like, on its face, it's a stupid thing to use your time to do. Yep. But we all love it and we all do it anyway. So if you don't have any sort of like reflection of how dumb it is, you know, you've, I think, lost the plot in a lot of ways. And I'm not just picking on boulders. I'd say that, you know, me soloing some aid climb on El Cap was fucking stupid, like on its face, you know, purposely taking my wonderful, clean, very safe life and putting it in danger for no particular reason. Stupid. Like, and so it's like all this stuff is dumb. And if you don't have a perspective on that, man, you've lost the plot completely.
I totally agree, but it's the people make this like leap from saying that climbing is dumb or using the word day flash is dumb or whatever it is to what they hear is, you're saying I'm dumb because I climb, or I'm dumb because I use day flash. It's like, well, no, it's not anywhere close to what I'm saying, actually. You know, it's like, it's just this oversensitivity to, I don't know, just, yeah. Making light of
or it is dumb, or you are saying they're dumb, but who cares? Because we do lots of dumb shit.
I did get a few,
including posting on Instagrams.
I made that point in my little thing, and a few people replied to me, and they were like, "Actually, people who do use day flash are also dumb." Like more than one person said to me that comment.
and it's also like hyperbole. Like that's the other thing people sort of don't get is it's like. And like absurdity and like taking a point beyond its like logic is part of humor. Like that's what humor kind of is. And also foibles is what I always say, which is a silly little word. But, you know, pointing out foibles of what we do as humans is literally, I mean, that's like the very, very base pillar of comedy, mm-hmm. right? Finding some silly thing that we do and poking fun at it. And the phrase poking fun can easily by somebody be extrapolated to bullying. I mean, it's really the same thing.
It's literally
it's
a
more
poke.
Intent.
Yeah. It's not a slap. Yeah. It's not a punch. It's a poke. You know, yes, it hurts a little bit. If you feel it, you know, you feel the indentation in your skin, right. But it's in fun. It's like it's not injurious.
Yeah. Well, anyhow. So, I mean, keep using it. We actually, you know, it's the ironic part of it is we use it all the time now. I was like with Andy the other day, you know, he flashed this route out in Maine Elk, and I was like, dude, day flash, did it. I mean, it is today, and you just flashed it, so here we go. Day flashed it.
Streisand affected this word into existence.
And then he did another one. I was like, double day flash, dog. Like, you got two day flashes. And I said, and then we decided that that the first day flash is when the clock starts. So now you have another 24 hours from whatever point you day flashed the first one to day flash as many other routes as you want.
Oh, interesting.
So I think he day flashed the first one at about 2. So we figured he had till 2 o'clock the next day to day flash. But then we started to debate whether you could go to sleep or not. If sleeping reset your day. So anyway. So yeah, we're always talking about the day flash now. Like always. I don't think I've gone climbing since TAPS that I haven't brought up the day flash. So anyway, so it's mine now. I get it. Yeah. I get to own it now.
You and your crew invented it.
My crew invented it. We're reinventing it. Thank you very much for the 21st century or the whatever century we're in. That started as soon as I said that.
And I love how all the people who are just like, why are you making fun of this word? Like, just leave people alone. You just do a little bit of probing into why they think that. And it's clear that they also use day flash, like in like genuinely.
And probably
it always comes
and probably
out.
Believed they invented it.
Yeah, exactly.
Anyway, there's several origins. That's the way etymology works, is there's several claimed origins. We'll have to put some sort of scholar on it to actually get to the bottom of it.
Well, day flash isn't really what we wanted to talk about today, is it, Chris?
No, it is not.
But before we get to our topic, okay. we have to address some feed. So last episode, we talked about the all-arounder, like the myth of the all-arounder, kind of what the all-arounder is. And this, we're kind of building on that into this new this new series.
I wouldn't say myth. Myth isn't the right word, yeah.
Just kind of defining what it is.
Right.
This kind of nebulous term or a climber type that you hear about but don't really know exactly what it means. And this week, we're going to talk about the undercover crusher, like the kind of the guy who's crushing that no one has ever heard of. But before we get there, we should just address a lot of feedback that we got on our last conversation, because I heard from a number of people that they were quite upset that we didn't include Dave McLeod in our list.
Well, first of all, we didn't create a list in that episode. Mm-hmm. Like, that was not, I was reading from other lists online, which was, you know, part of why it was funny, is because those lists,
yes,
you know, definitely were in strange orders, as it were. So, and I actually kind of was careful not to try to create a list, because one time years ago, we were talking about women. I think it was women who had climbed a certain grade, and we had like a list of the top, maybe the top female climbers or something like that, of like who had climbed whatever 14D or something like that before 15A had been done, and we missed a couple, and of course we. Not only were we accused of being idiots, we were accused of being misogynistic, because our lack of defining, you know, one that we missed one in the record. And so when we got to this one, I was like, I'm not doing a list, because I'm not going to like miss the person. And then also, it's like that thing had a very definable quality to it, because it was a certain grade that we were talking about. And this is undefinable. And so there was no way we could create the ultimate list, because there's somebody out there that agrees that that they don't get on there. And Dave McLeod, he's not on my list. Sorry, everybody, he doesn't make it, because he doesn't climb big routes. And we definitely talked about going far away expedition climbing was part of being an all-arounder. So yes, he sport climbs really hard. Yes, he boulders really hard. Yes, he does trad climbing. But it's trad sport, in my opinion, where it's like you work it like a sport route, because a lot of those really hard routes he didn't do ground up. Which
he's also free soloed like 14A or whatever too,
right?
Which I think is pretty rad.
So he gets in there, but he doesn't quite make it. So until I see him suffering in a portal edge in a storm somewhere, he doesn't make it on my list. But your list could include him, and I'm sure he's going to be super bummed to find out that Chris Kaluza doesn't think he's
makes it
to the all runner list. I'm crushing his soul right now, as he's eating another fucking patty. He just choked on it a little bit. Hamburger patty.
And he's going to send you all his buns.
Right.
For your bun diet.
My bun diet. No, he's going to stop sending them. Yeah. Anyhow, I will stand by that.
I think
he's one of the greatest climbers of all time for sure. True all arounder. I don't know.
I just thought there was like this interesting kind of commentary to make about why he came to the forefront of so many people's minds. And I think that it's just really, well, I think he is deserving of being on an all around list on some level, maybe not your list, but
I'm being hard.
Yeah. You're being a stickler right now, but he's certainly talented in many disciplines of climbing. No doubt about that. But I like you sticking to your guns on the big route and adventure climbing stuff, but let me land the point I was going to make, I think that he's successfully kind of marketed himself as a professional who is this all-around climber. Mm-hmm. And I think that's why so many people, like, that marketing basically worked. And he, you know, he's constantly referred to as like an all-around great climber, you know, by mm-hmm. the UK media or by himself, and in the way that he kind of positions himself as a professional. And so I think that that is just interesting to consider. Like, when a climber, especially in the professional world, they do market themselves on in some way. They have some angle or whatever shtick or something that they kind of hew to. It's their little bio that gets read before their corporate talk that they deliver, you know. And his says all around climber, I presume. Yeah. And so, I think that's why a lot of people popped into their head as an omission in our episode.
All right, we'll grandfather him in. Well, the other thing I was thinking about this, because I you sent me some of this stuff that about Dave McLeod being denied. The other thing that helps me think about these guys or girls is the world traveling thing is also sort of important to me. Is that because it sort of speaks to someone wanting to challenge themselves in, you know, on mediums that are different and strange and out of their wheelhouse, so to speak. And that for me I was thinking about, we didn't mention it, but it's sort of a defining element of the all around climber. And it speaks to that idea of like, I want to be able to do this thing on whatever you throw at me. And in some ways I feel like Dave is a very specialized climber then, because of his sort of range of where he has, you know, defined himself on those climbs and in those places. And, you know, I'm certain he probably travels and we just don't hear about it. But again, going back to his marketing, it's kind of, you know, in a cool way, you know, he's found this like range within this area of his homeland that he can do all these different things. Mm-hmm. So it's not that it's not cool. Again, like this kind of ranging out into the world to define or to challenge yourself is sort of, in my mind, part of it in a lot of ways.
Yeah, no, I think just to repeat what you're saying, it's like he's missing out on one of the best parts of climbing, at least on his, like, the way he presents his professional side of his climbing career. It's like there's not a lot of, there's no travel, there's no, like, big, you know, adventure to, like, a new place to do a big route or whatever.
Right, and it's all, you know, it's partially just his life. He's got kids, and he's created this great career out of being local, which is admirable. And again, it's all based on what we know about him. Maybe hundreds of trips elsewhere that he's just never really talked about or we haven't noticed, but it's definitely part of his vibe is to do his thing there. And especially in a modern world, you know, where we're talking about your footprint on the world, it's this admirable thing. Mm-hmm. So it's not like something we're like dissing him for.
He should get microchipped and go climb Everest.
Get what?
Microchipped.
What does that mean?
There's these new regulations that Nepal's has just released that all climbers on Everest now have to have like a tracking device on them.
Really?
Yeah. So I've been calling it microchip, like they're fucking dogs or whatever.
Yeah, they'd stick it under your skin, on your neck or something. That'd be amazing.
You need your rabies vaccine and your microchip before you can climb Everest.
Oh, man. Is it because people are sneaking in there and stuff and denying them their money? What's going on with that? Never mind.
I think it's just to find their bodies when they die on the summit ridge. Yeah.
All right. Yeah.
Anyway, we can beat that old dead horse in the next episode.
I know. That's why I was just like, wait a second. Do we have to do this again?
All right. So, okay. So
it does get dumber and dumber though, doesn't it?
It does. It won't stop either.
It won't stop. No.
Everest has gone to like dog park rules this year because you have to carry wag bags to pick up your poop and you need to be microchipped.
And yet you can't be off leash on the trek in either.
This seems like a good job for AI to create like a dog park on Everest. Anyway, Chris, let's talk about what we wanted to talk about, which is the undercover crusher. What is that?
So I had two thoughts on this. I was thinking about this, and there's like the undercover crusher that's kind of real and we know about. And I've got a couple names in mind. And once again, I'm not creating a list where I leave your favorite climbing girl or guy off of it and you get mad. But I have a couple in mind to sort of define it. But then there's also this kind of, the mythological part of it is this, sometimes you just hear about this supposed, you know, literally mythological creature that, you know, probably was there before you and probably climbed those routes that you're claiming as a first ascent. I think this happens a lot in bouldering in particular, but just never told anybody. And therefore, you know, your claim of a first ascent is possibly and probably invalid because of whoever, like Franz from Bavaria, that was climbing it and didn't bother telling anybody or whatever. So those are kind of the two prongs of this. One of which I think we kind of like the all arounder. We have this, at least I have this certain admiration for the quote unquote undercover crusher, the person who goes about their business sending hard and doesn't spray about it. And then I have I'm sort of this skeptic about this, like these mythological people that were there first, and because it becomes this like really undefinable thing that can be used to rain on anyone's parade, you know, saying that literally someone could have, for example, could have free sold El Cap and not told anybody about it. Mm-hmm. You know, some you know, amazing French climber in the 80s just walked up there and sent it and left and we never heard about it. You could basically say that about just about anywhere and anything, like theoretically. Anyhow,
yeah,
those are my two prongs, if you will.
Yeah, those are good starting points. I will say that I did have the experience of seeing on social media someone posting their first ascent of a boulder problem out in Castle Valley that I had climbed along with Jeff Jackson and Dwayne Raleigh 10 years earlier. And so that was like, I mean, I think that just kind of underscores the bouldering aspect of it a little bit, especially these kind of more remote and sandy places that, you know, don't get a lot of traffic. I think it's certainly easy to see come up on a boulder. It's really dirty. It looks like it hasn't been climbed because it's been a few years and it's just been the sand has just been eroded down and it just feels like had never been brushed before. So I think that can happen a lot. I mean, it's personally happened to me. I don't know how often it happens, but yeah, I think that a lot of people use that trope of like, well, someone could have come and done this and who knows. I guess there's a couple ways that they use it. One is like this charitable way of just having humility with like, you know, who knows, maybe there are strong climbers who are just as strong as us who've done this thing that we're talking about. But then there's this other way that people use it, which is like trying to undercut, you know, someone's achievement. I think like if you think that you're like the fourth ascent of some local, you know, route, but then you realize that, you know, someone might say, make an underhanded comment like that, like, oh, dude, probably like 10 other people that you've just never heard of have also done that too.
Yeah, right. That's kind of the way I'm always like a little bit skeptical of it. Mm-hmm. But yeah, the bouldering thing is important because there's just not often a lot of evidence of that, you know, versus like finding the Piton,
right?
And knowing that someone had in fact climbed it before. But yeah, I'm more speaking of that kind of thing, like, oh, you think you're cool, well, you probably aren't because you did this. And this happened to me with incident, well, not really incident, but this on, you know, I posted some pictures, like just nostalgia. You know, I have to post like nostalgic pictures about my climbing because I don't do anything interesting anymore. Every once in a while on Instagram, just to kind of like keep my street cred up. And it was about having climbed all the Bridger Jack spires in a day, which is like 8 summits. The way we defined it, it's 8 summits. Other people define it as 7, but I used qualifying words in it, like, you know, likely. I remember using the word likely the first time. And the reason I kind of feel like it was is because it was the 90s and the other people who had almost done it was Kenan Harvey and Marco Cornicchione. Marco Cornicchione being the author of the very first guidebook to Indian Creek. Also a partner of the Ruckmans, who were early developers in Indian Creek. And so a guy who's in the know, and when they were doing it, they were fairly convinced that that no one had ever done that before in the 80s and 90s. But anyway, so then a guy and they had done it as well. And so he kind of pushed back that, you know, how do I know it was the first? And like, he said something like, we did it as well around that time, but they added the six shooters, which is rad. You know, that's a lot of travel to across it, and totally rad feat. One thing was like, we did it in 1998, and he didn't say this, but I figured out that they had done it in 2012. Mm. And so it's like
right around that time. You know,
right around that time. And it's like, well, I mean, in chronological time space, we did it before you. And I mean, I don't care. It wasn't like I was like, yeah, well, fuck you. You know, we did it. But I was just like, how do you, you know, it's definable when someone did something and when something, you know, or it was 2011. Anyway, it was a decade later.
We don't know about wormholes yet.
Yeah. I might have all these dates messed up, but whatever happened, it was like definably after. But then the comment that, and I think it was like something along the lines of some Euro or someone might have done it. And, you know, again, yes, like in there is a multiverse universe where some Euro did it before us because all things are possible. But saying something like that to a post like mine was basically like, shut the fuck up, you don't know what you're talking about kind of thing. So I just found it to be strange. You. Yeah, a little poke. Yeah, yeah. Anyhow.
Hey, I know this guy named Some Euro, and he might have done this.
No, it's actually Some Euro sounds like more like a Korean name. Yeah. But although not with the R in it. But anyhow. But yeah. So that was a long time ago. But when I was thinking about this. But what about the true undercover crusher? Like, you got any names in mind?
We both have a name in mind of an undercover crusher. Let's say it on three and see if we're thinking of the same person.
Okay.
1, 2, 3. Nacho Sanchez.
James Litz. Nacho Sanchez? No. We didn't.
I was thinking of maybe saying BJ Tilden, but he's kind of not. He has that reputation, but he's. I feel like he's too well known at this point to be undercover.
Right. So who did you say, Nacho Sanchez?
Yeah, Nacho Sanchez.
Who is that?
Exactly.
That doesn't sound real.
Nacho Sanchez is a name that I saw on 8A.NU like a decade ago, and he came through Rifle and like did all these random things, like these like hard 13Ds and shit that no one's climbed like in decades. And I was just like, is this a, I thought it was a joke account, but there's a real dude named Nacho Sanchez who like crushes in Spain. So Hopefully he's listening to this podcast and will come on and be a guest on our show.
And you, it was, because I remember that now.
Yeah.
And we all decided that it kind of couldn't happen. Like, we would have noticed.
Yeah.
But you think it did happen.
I think it did. And I think he's legit. Yeah. I think I've heard from a couple people that there's a real Nacho Sanchez who's an absolute crusher. But, and he came right through our home turf and right, like, during a time when we were both, you know, climbing a lot more than we are now. And we didn't see him or meet him. And he just, like, crushed a bunch of roots.
All right. Well, mine was James Litz.
James Litz is also an undercover crusher.
That guy, like, whatever is posted about him, I don't think is posted by him.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, being an undercover crusher is harder now because people will be talking about you. But, like, he's a Salt Lake guy. I don't know if he's still active, but definitely, like, well-known for putting up those boulder problems and those sport routes that were, you know, harder than anything anyone was basically climbing, at least anyone that were non-professional at the very top end of the grade, years ago. And I probably, like, boulder problems that still haven't been repeated for all I know, but he always comes to mind as, and I don't know anything about him. I've sort of, like, looked him up to try to get an interview with him. I think he's, like, moved on.
He's really reticent. Extent. No, he still climbs, yeah. I think.
Right.
He's really reticent. And he has been covered, you know, by the climbing media, but it's always through, like, kind of third-hand stories and stuff. I don't know if he's actually ever given much of an interview anywhere. But, yeah, it's a good name. But I think Nacho Sanchez takes the cake for me.
Well, then there's this guy who's gone back undercover, and that would be Nale Hukatival. That's an interesting one to me because he's fallen off the, like, public map. And I even made a joke of it when I talked to Anna Leitinen. She confirmed he still climbs, he still trains. He's like in Rocklands, and he's also maybe developing some other area in South Africa. And then I kind of figured out that for him to remain undercover, now that he clearly wants to have walked away from it to a certain extent, and he's not active in any talk about Burden of Dreams. We didn't see him popping up when those guys sent it and stuff. So he's actively removed himself for personal reasons. And but he also must kind of have a moratorium on anyone posting anything about him.
Mm.
Because you would imagine that anybody could get clicks on their Rocklands, you know, Instagrams if they just even shot a picture of him sending, or here's Nale still in it or whatever. And you don't see that anywhere. So I feel like he's somehow controlling that as well, because you don't have a lot of control over who posts what about you. But anyway, and it's
like
funny
a good,
because
a real rock film, like, where in the world is Nale Hukatival?
Yeah, totally. I think that's a good one. If, as long as he would participate, or even if he wouldn't, just be like, they could do it as like a JFK, like, conspiracy movie, just all this, like, grainy footage from, like, far away, you know, or whatever's going on with, like, there's some princess in England that's, like, supposedly
Kate Middleton.
Read about this. Yeah. Middleton. It'd be like a Kate Middleton thing where they just have these blurry photos from behind that try to find Nale. But the funny thing is I have, like, the utmost respect for it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, I interviewed him a while ago, thought he was a super nice guy. And of course he's this amazing boulderer, but now I'm just like, he's the fucking man. Because the other one that made me think of it is, that also did a similar thing was Clem Loscott.
Mm-hmm.
As he went, he bailed for the longest time and then he popped back up. But he was out, like, world surfing. Like, he was on these amazing surf safaris and just dropped out of climbing and disappeared after being, like, you know, super famous for the Seiko block and all that sort of thing. So, and for some reason, I have a really warm place in my heart for those who walk away and like, stop all the bullshit and just go do what they want to do.
I'm imagining if you're at a crag, like, how would you know if someone's an undercover crusher and they would be wearing, like, those... one of those, like, glasses with the fake nose and mustache, like, a costume. Like
the Groucho Marx.
Yeah. You're like, wait a second, that's Nale.
Wait a second. He's like, oh, I don't know what you're talking about. And he just turns and walks away. I mean, you know, the pandemic thing, you could have hidden under your mask, but yeah, I don't know. I have a lot of respect for I think we all do, right?
For sure.
Especially as like the whirlwind of like self-promotion has gotten so out of hand. And like, we've talked about this on the show before. I mean, it was a matter of style. I mean, we were talking to Beth Rodden about it. It was a matter of style, actually, in her era. So let's say 20 years ago, to be undercover. Like, you did not spray about yourself. Mm-hmm. You let it kind of happen. And now that like the coin's been completely flipped in that you have to sort of talk about yourself.
These people exist and we respect and laud them and salute them for their, active, because you kind of have to actively not self-promote. I mean, like, the right. default is self-promote, and like, so to not self-promote requires more effort, that, you know? And so we respect them and salute them for their effort that they're making and not self-promoting. But to bring it back home to the first point you made, like, don't be the guy who's just like, well, some Euro like free soloed this thing. Like, so shut the
Nale
fuck up. Nale did it. Oh, it's like, you're just making stuff up and you're just doing it to like be a dick right now.
That's true. I always say, like, it's super cool. It's super uncool to try to be cool. And I guess it kind of fits with that, right? If you're just like that kind of person, then your whole, it's like normcore, you know, like your whole effort to seem normal is like beyond what everybody else right. is doing to seem cool. So actually, you're fucking lame if you're not promoting yourself on Instagram. That's what it comes down to.
Man, I can't keep it straight anymore.
Yeah, exactly.
Will Moss is a comp climber turned traddy from New York City, and he's been quietly ticking some of the hardest gear-protected routes in the country over the past couple years. His most recent notable ascent is an FA of the Gunk's Hardest, The Best Things in Life Are Free, 514DR.
So, Will, I'd like you to respond to this statement that I found on Reddit that refers to you, and it says, a literal team kid infiltrated the old trad dad scene in the Gunks in a big way. How would you characterize that statement? Mostly true, all the way true, extremely true?
I guess mostly true. I was always a team kid, like... Started climbing in gyms, competing a lot, and mostly climbing inside, doing some outdoor climbing, but not a bunch. It was usually the indoor climbing was mostly my main focus. But then during COVID, when all the climbing competitions kind of stopped happening, I would go to train at this rock in Central Park called Rat Rock, and I reconnected with one of my old friends there named Carter. And he was getting into trad climbing and like had been doing it for a while and kind of wanted to show me how to do it. And then I gladly took him up on that offer because there were really no competitions happening at that time. And once I learned trad climbing, I liked it more than any other form of climbing, and then just like really started to push my limits with it because there wasn't a ton of sport climbing near New York City. It was closer than Rumney, which was like 6 hours away. Mostly because the Gunks, even though it's such a cool area, people were like really against bolting it, which totally makes sense because there's a lot of availability for natural protection there. Once my friend showed me how to do it, I just really enjoyed like pushing my limits with it and just like getting into this new sport. And yeah, that was really fun. So yeah, I mean, it definitely is mostly true because I went from being a team kid and then once I got into trad climbing, just pushing my limits on trad in a different way than competitions.
And you're from deep in the city? New York? I mean, is that where you grew up?
Yeah, I grew up
like
in
near
that.
Central Park?
Yeah.
Oh. There's so many things I want to ask you about that because we'll get through your progression. But I also want to ask you about Rat Rock because I've heard so many different things about this little rock. Is it? Well, tell me what it's like. I mean, I know tons of people that have stopped by and climbed there. But what is it like to train, quote unquote, as you said, on Rat Rock?
Yeah, so it's like not really a good climbing rock. It's like a small rock. in Central Park. But during COVID, when all the gyms were closed, it was kind of all that I had. I mean, what I would do is there's this like one like classic sandbag V5 called Polish Traverse. And my training would kind of be like a combination of multiple things. So I would guess I would start off by saying there's like two boulders in Central Park, Rat Rock and Worthless Boulder. On Rat Rock, there's this one traverse on, I don't know if maybe it was like the west side or something, but whatever. It's this one V5 traverse, and my main training like for endurance would be to traverse back and forth on that as many times as I could. And then as well as for power, I would try and campus it and successfully eventually, and then like campus it there and back, which I never got. But and then on the back side of that boulder, there's this like wall. It's probably like 20 degrees overhung. There's like a couple of good climbs on it, but then there's also just like a bunch of holds on it. So I was doing like all sorts of eliminates and like whatever I could make up to be hard. And then the other rock, Worthless Boulder, had a couple of like hard climbs. There's like this V10 traverse on it and like a couple other things that I was training on back then. But that was like my main training. It's not like a good rock, but during COVID, when there were no other or no climbing gyms at all open, a lot of people would go there, and it was like a really fun community. And it was a good time during COVID, but not sure that I would want to like have that be my main training ground again.
So, Will, tell us how old you are.
I'm 19 years old.
Okay. Yeah. So Chris and I, often, don't get a chance to talk to folks of your generation. And so I thought it would just be interesting to hear how you think of what trad climbing is. Like, how do you define what is trad climbing? Like, just tell us in your own words what it is, as if we didn't know.
I guess trad climbing is the type of climbing where you bring up the gear on your harness and place it as you climb, and place removable gear that you climb, place it on lead, clip it as your protection, and then the follower can take out when they follow you up the route.
Yeah, so you have a super interesting background, just being like kind of growing up in this gym context and then getting into more adventurous climbing. I read somewhere that you were kind of inspired to start trad climbing because of a video you saw. Is there any truth to that?
Oh yeah, that's very true.
Tell us about what video you saw and what it was that sparked your fancy.
So that video was The Lifer, with like talking about the history of the Gunks with Russ Kloon, Lynn Hill, and a lot of other famous people like Al Diamond back in the day. Modern focus of the film and what they were currently filming was filming Sam Elias on Brozone, and that was kind of what like mainly got me into it. There were just like a bunch of awesome drone shots and all of that just made the Ozone Buttress, which I ended up spending a lot of time on, just look really cool. And I had no idea that there was like this much overhung, like cool, hard climbing on the cliffs of the Gunks. I kind of always assumed like whenever people would come down, they come down with like 30 pounds of gear on their harness and be like, oh, this 5.6 was so cool. And I was like, oh, I don't know if I would enjoy climbing 5.6 that much. But once I saw this video, I was like, oh my God, that looks like the coolest sport climb ever, except you just protected by trad gear. And it just really got me psyched on the sport. And I didn't really get into it too soon after, just because like, I didn't really have a friend at the time who knew how. Like, that was probably like a good couple months before COVID that I like saw it for the first time. I remember I was like watching it at practice, just like, oh my God, this is epic. My coach even got mad. She was like, you shouldn't watch outdoor climbing videos at practice. It takes away from your training. And I was just, I got like so stoked on it though.
You got and scolded then, for.
It's like the weed dealer. Yeah. Or the pot dealer had showed up. She's like, get out of here. They're trying to corrupt my athletes.
Yeah. But eventually when I finally got into it with my friend over COVID, I was like, that was like always the final goal. I was like, I need to get on Ozone and I need to get on Brozone. And it happened right away. Like, obviously I had to work up to it, but like the like first day I got on it, it like felt like so much like the film, and it was like such a surreal experience. And it just felt like probably at the time, the most fun thing I had ever done with climbing, just like being on the Ozone Buttress higher than I had ever been before, even though it was like 200 feet. I just like hadn't really climbed that high. And it was probably like one of the coolest views ever, because you're like above the tree line, seeing way out and like in that huge roof. It really felt like the film. And that film was definitely like what got me stoked and gave me the idea to try like Ozone and Brozone and get into trad climbing so I could eventually get to that level.
Your coach also knew in her heart of hearts that trad climbing is the coolest form of climbing, and she just didn't want you to find that out. So let me ask you this with the gear, like, and again, you know, a lot of these articles or things that I read maybe compressed it a little bit, but maybe they didn't. But it seemed like, you know, your progression to sort of learning how the gear worked to, you know, taking whips on it and that kind of thing was pretty fast. And, I was about to say traditionally, but I guess I have to use that word. You know, there's this long progression. So tell me a little bit about that. I mean, was there trepidation for you about that usually goes with, like, you know, nuts and cams and things at first have fallen on them? Yeah, how did you sort of take to that?
I mean, I guess, like, I forget all of, I mean, not all of it, but, like, some the exact progression of it, totally. But I think, like, I did, like, 2 days where I was kind of just, like, following my friend. And one thing that I also did during those days is he would, like, set up a top rope and then have
did
me,
you
like,
say 2 days?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay.
Yeah.
Keep going.
And he would have me, like, mock lead trad climbs, which I think was really good because I think what he said at the time and what made sense to me a lot is that, like, a lot of people kind of just follow their leader and just, like, take the gear out and don't really understand, like, how it goes in and, like, what's good about good gear and bad about not so good gear. So what he did is he would, like, set up top ropes and then, like, allow me to, like, go up on top rope but placing the trad gear on, like, as if I were on lead instead of just taking it out. And he would always go up and he'd, like, give it A to F of, like, how good the gear was. And I think this was super helpful in allowing me to understand, like, what gear was good and what gear wasn't so good. And I think that led into my quick progression of, like, once he was like, oh, these were actually all really good, I was like, okay, like, I think I could maybe lead something. And my first lead, I think it was, like, 5.3, and then after that, maybe, like, 5.6. But then after that, there was this, like, really well-protected 5.12 called the Sting, which just, like, boulder problems separated by, like, perfect horizontals. So it was, like, super obvious. And, yeah, I mean, I think that was, like, third day leading when I did this thing, and it was like that was also really cool too. It wasn't quite the ozone buttress, it was like pretty short, close to the ground, but I was also like, oh wow, like I'm pulling like moves that aren't that easy, like above gear and that I placed on lead. And then I think after I did that, I unclipped the anchors and took my first trad fall to kind of like test out the gear. I think it was ridiculous. I think like in the horizontal below I placed like 4 cams and like 1 horizontal, but I just really wanted to like take the fall on gear. And I remember it was this cam that like my dad got me forever ago. He was like, got me a cam and like a set of nuts, and he was like, one day you might need this. And I was like, maybe I like bouldering. But then like I brought it there, and I mean my friend probably didn't want me to like fall and tweak his gear if I wasn't even like actually falling. So I like had that clip the highest, and I like fell on it and it held, and that was the first time I fell on gear, and I was like, okay, that held just like a bolt would, like I could probably push this a little further. And then I think maybe like a session later, I got on Suppers Ready, which felt like my first like real hard trad lead, because the Sting is just like very obvious. Like, you know what you're getting into from the ground, like exactly what to place. I had done it on top rope before too, but Suppers Ready, I watched like one video online and it kind of didn't go as planned, because the video online, I really realized that like not all cams were black diamond at the time. I was like, oh, they're green and red cams, like they're 0.75s and one. So I brought up like a double rack or like a triple rack of those and like a decent amount of everything else. But when I got up there, like some places I didn't really have what I wanted, and I had to like figure it out with like horizontal nut placements, which seemed weird. But in the end, I got through it and like got the flash on that route. And that definitely felt like the first hard like trad route where I was like figuring it out on the go, like actually dealing with problems, and that was really fun too. And then I think the next session was the first time I got on ozone.
Wow. I want to ask you about how you first got into climbing, but just quickly give us just a background, some context of how like maybe hard you were sport climbing at the time, when this progression into the world of trad happened. Like what was your kind of general ability, either in the gym or up at Rumney?
Yeah, so I think my general ability is I had, like, bouldered V10 at the time. And I think, like, right at the beginning of when I got into trad, I was, like, close on this 13D, but hadn't done it. And then, like, right before I got on ozone, I did a trip out to Rumney and, like, sent this 13D. But that was like kind of where my grades were at, like V10, 13D.
Yeah, and so that was like comparable basically with what you were aspiring to in the trad world as well. So
tell us
about how you first got into climbing. Do you come from a family of climbers? How did you get into the sport?
No, so I mean, my dad grew up here in Colorado. Actually, I have like a decent amount of family here, but he never climbed at all. He was into like high jump and basketball, but in the city, like basically the first time I really got into climbing was there was this gym like two blocks from my house on 97th Street. And we kind of like walked there for the first time. And I don't know, I think my dad and my sister were like really psyched on it, but I was like, oh, I don't know. I was kind of into gaming at the time. I was like, I think the money we spent on a game or a day pass, I could get like the new version of Minecraft or something. I don't know. I was like into that at the time, I guess. But then once we got into climbing gym, I was totally in love with it. Like, did it as much as I possibly could, and that was like the first time I got into it. And my family, or like my dad and my sister, did it for a little bit. My sister was like more into gymnastics, so she kind of stuck with that. And then my dad kind of got more into like running long distances and like triathlons and stuff like that. But I really liked climbing and stuck with it. But that was where it started.
And tell us a little bit more about those years in the gym, because you got into competitions. Were you like formally on a team, or like how did all of that work?
So my first team was this gym called Steep Rock Bouldering, which got bought by Vital. but I was on the team there. It was like Steep Rockers. And I think I was on that team for a couple years. Went to Nationals like twice with that team, and then moved to Brooklyn Boulders Queensbridge, then the Cliffs at Long Island City. And then after COVID, I was kind of just like training with friends. I didn't really join the team after that. I still did comps, but I wasn't like officially on a team after that. But those were the teams I was on.
And where is your climbing ability as a kid? Like, were you really good right away, basically? Or was there like years of growth and hardship that you're not disclosing right now?
I think I was like pretty decent, and then I think I just did it so much and was like really excited to do it all the time that I did get good that way.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, I don't know, I definitely loved it a lot, but I would say like the place where my strength even took off the most was like when I got into trad climbing. It just seemed like something that was cooler than anything I had done before, and like I had known all the ways to train in the gym, stuff like that, but once I got into trad climbing, it just made me more psyched than I had ever been before, which really like went into my training, and that got me like a much stronger progression.
So let me try to kind of get you to expand. We'll see if this works. But you're just like, yeah, this just grabbed me. You know, these things grabbed me. I just thought it was the coolest thing. Can you talk at all about why you think, or what the differences are, or do you enjoy sort of the intellectual part of figuring out the gear in addition to the moves? You know, do you like the thrill of climbing above trad gear? What is it versus going and doing big sport climbs or something like that?
I think like a lot of it was like I actually like do like dealing with gear and like figuring it out on lead. Like, it does add another mental challenge. Like, I've done a couple routes now that like have bolts on it, but I've just been so enticed by the challenge of doing it with placing, or with only clipping what I place on lead, that I'll lead those trad routes and do them on trad gear if they go. But I think at the time it was definitely like kind of seeing that film and like kind of living that actual experience like in the Twilight Zone buttress. And that was like definitely like taller than any sport route I had done, because it was like the second pitch, and it just really felt like you were up there, and it just felt like a lot more adventurous. And then like once I started doing like some multi-pitch trad climbing, even like a trip over the summer, like I really liked that type of thing where like we went and it was like a really long day and like a little adventurous. Like, we did like the Grand Teton and the Cirque Traverse, which became a little of an adventure because we kind of underestimated it. But just like the combination of the intellectual aspect, the trying hard, and the adventure of it just like really caught my attention.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. I mean, the first thing that like jumped out, I think, for everybody that, you know, didn't really know you beforehand, was this the best things in life are free up in the Gunks. And it's funny because when I read descriptions of it, you know, the descriptions very much play up the runouts and all these sorts of things. And I feel like that's not, that's them doing that. It's not necessarily coming from you, but you know, how do you approach these climbs that have big runout? You know, the whole thing with trad climbing is kind of around that a little bit, is that you don't just have a bolt every time you need it and you have to push yourself up high above the gear. Like, tell us a little bit about that approach to that route and dealing with those runouts and taking big whippers apparently as well. It's just funny because it's like I don't see your personal media, your Instagram, anything playing any of that up, but all the articles that sort of talked about it wanted everybody to know how run out you were.
I don't think I was attracted to the route because it was a run out or whatever, because it was dangerous and whatnot. I was just attracted to the route because it was like such a king line. Like, basically Ozone and Brozone kind of like traverse around this one section of rock and come back. So it like traverses away from the steep climbing, goes up an easier section, traverses back on jugs to like get back to that main line. But this line just like went straight through the middle, and it just felt like such a cool line. And all that time that I had spent like on the Ozone buttress, I did Ozone, then Brozone, then Friendzone, which was just like another variation. It was pretty cool, but it wasn't quite as cool as the full thing, Best Things. It like does the first boulder and then traverses over and then comes back. But once I like knew that Best Things went, I was just like really psyched on that idea, because it just goes straight through this roof. And it's like, every time you look at the Ozone buttress, it's like the final roof is 25 feet, like completely overhung. And it's just so inspiring. And all the other climbs kind of traverse like from the left side, like on jugs, like not really climbing out of it. But this was like the final project, the king line, and it just like went straight out the roof. So, and it just kind of happened that there like wasn't really any gear close to the point of the roof that you were climbing to where you get your first piece of gear since that last piece. So I definitely like wasn't really, yeah, necessarily attracted to the runout, but just attracted to the line itself. And I wanted to do whatever I could to make it as safe as possible while still getting the send. And I guess my approach to that was, basically for a while, my friends were working on making this film about the gunks, or originally about Friend Zone, but now about Best Things. But whenever they would go up there, I would always like try that crux on top rope. Once we're done with the filming, I would go down, like work it on top rope, and just like never really found a path until the next fall, when I finally like figured out some beta that would work. And that like took me a while, because I mean, I wasn't like trying it with anyone. I was kind of like sticking to the same sequences and stuff like that. But I eventually found this beta that worked, and I kind of just like worked it out as much as possible. And I did take some falls, like once I finally commit to the lead, but I never took the fall when I was upside down, because that was the only beta I was able to find. And that wasn't necessarily something I wanted to do either. Like, I definitely like rehearsed it a bunch, so I didn't have to do that. But it was like one of those situations where like could be fine, could maybe not, but it was just such an inspiring line. I wanted to put all the work into it to make it possible. And then once it felt good, I eventually went for it.
And how'd you land on the grade? Because it's got a big number attached to it.
Like, it starts, it kind of does all the hard climbing of Brozone. And then where Brozone splits out, does this like V5 boulder. It does this like V10 boulder, which is the first boulder of Friend Zone. And then where Friend Zone traverses left, this thing like goes straight. You get like two pretty good resting holds. But then there's just like another really hard boulder going through the roof. I think it's like V11. I think it took me a while to do, partially because I had bad beta, but mostly because it was just like really hard. And just adding that extra boulder, as well as the one before, it just felt like it deserved that grade. I mean, I guess I haven't actually done any sport routes that hard, but right before it, I had flashed 14B, the New River Gorge, and sent 14C within like five goes. And this was something that was like the culmination of all the years of trad climbing that I had put in since like the end of ninth grade. Like, when I was projecting Ozone, projecting Brozone, Friend Zone, like those climbs were all part of this climb. And then all the extra sessions I put into doing Best Things was just like way more than I had worked on any other route before. So just like based off of time span too, I feel like that's usually the best judge of giving something a grade. This just took me like much longer than anything I had done near that grade.
Was this your first ascent?
Well, I did Friend Zone, which was like,
oh, okay.
I mean, it could be yours too. Variation, but like I did that. But I mean, it was one of my firsts. Like, I had done a first gear ascent, which I don't know if it really counts, of this climb over the moon. Andy Salo did it on pre-place gear. And I was able to place the gear on Salo. he's cool, but I was like, I think I was like a little.
He's a really good friend of ours.
No, he's really cool.
He's awesome.
But
I just hope he listens.
I think I was like a little taller, maybe able to get this like cam placement in that he wasn't or something like that. But that was like a semi first ascent. And then I did friend zone. And then after that, there was this other route that this guy, Rich Romano, he was a really strong climber at the Gunks way back in the day. Climbed at this really adventurous part of the Gunks called Millbrook, which I've done a fair amount of fun climbing at. But he would always tell me about these projects that he had in mind. And one of them was like to the right of this classic 5.8 called Arrow. And this was like a pretty cool route too. It was just like climbed out this overhang, kind of like a perfect 30-degree overhang, like kind of a boulder, but that's what a lot of the routes of the Gunks were. But that was one of my other first ascents. And then after that, it was Best Things. But yeah, I mean, I hadn't done a bunch of first ascents before.
That's pretty cool. You're interacting with Rich Romano. He's a total legend. And what about the other trad dads, the other old guard? Did you ever get in with Russ? You know, after seeing the lifer and anybody else out there that was sort of helping you along?
Yeah, I climbed with Russ a bit. I hung out with him like one day at Millbrook, and he's super nice. I'd ask him about other climbs and stuff like that, and give information. He just did this like interview for the film that my friends are making about the climb that I did, which will hopefully be really fun. But he was really interesting too. It was cool to hear his stories as well and the information that he had to give.
You did another 14 trad climb in Index. I saw some footage of that. Am I correct that had been done, but it had been done with a couple bolts, and you skipped those bolts and placed some marginal nuts instead? Tell us about that route, and then I want to talk about that style choice that you made.
En passant, been done before. There were like two bolts kind of on the face, but I kind of just saw that it was like pretty obvious that it went on trad gear. It just felt like a really cool kind of challenge for the trip and something that would be like really fun to like climb and figure out. So I just got really psyched on that goal and eventually did it by the end of the trip.
That's the best chess move, by the way, en passant. So what... Yeah. What was the style choice that you made? Like, why were you, like, why skip the bolt? I mean, you're too young to kind of remember, like, the bickering and arguments and stuff that people had about whether you should make a big deal of, like, doing sport climbs without the bolts or, like, skipping bolts and making a big deal of it. But you kind of did this all very quietly, and so I'm not saying that you were trying to make a big statement, but I guess that's what makes it even more interesting, is because you just did this without clipping the bolt. So why did you do that?
I mean, it just felt like a challenge to me. Like, although I wasn't around for all of the bickering over bolting or not bolting and all that, I've definitely seen a lot of films about it. And I don't think it was anything like that. I was never like, this route shouldn't have been bolted or something like that. Like, it was a pretty, I mean, it made sense to bolt. It was like, you could place some small nuts or you could just like place two bolts. I'm not like against placing bolts. I think that was totally fine. And I did it originally on bolts, but I just kind of wanted to get like the purest ascent of that, I guess. And originally the plan was to like do this first ascent that hadn't been done, where basically en passant, the original aid line goes straight up like all the way to the top, which is, it's like really long and tall. Basically, like free climbing wise, would do all of the hard bits of en passant and then add this like V7 boulder like right at the end of that that's like really insecure, where en passant kind of just like grabs this one crimp, like throws feet out right and kind of just goes to the right. So originally I just wanted like to have a really cool goal and challenge and do it in the style that I felt was like the purest and most fun, and that was to do the whole route all the way to the top without clipping any of the bolts. And I was working on it for a while, and then like even though I did it on bolts, for some reason like it didn't feel too necessarily too hard to like add the gear, and it definitely added a little bit of danger aspect for the top. Like for the crux there were like really good nuts that I wasn't worried about blowing or anything. And then at the top, like mini crux, there was that like 5 kilonewton nut, which is like a little marginal. And like, yeah, with my original goal, I wanted to climb all the way to the top, and kind of on the last day of the trip, I like finally got past like this bit where I had been falling before. But after that, I kind of like saw the rope pull at this nut in kind of a weird way, because the nut was like good downwards, but it's one of those things where it's like not in very far. So if it goes up at all, like it could just come right out. And I kind of like saw that happen and I was like, all right, I gotta go right. And that was kind of like the decision I made there. So instead of doing the whole route, it kind of just like, I had my little safety decision and decided to go out right. But I mean, overall, like I've done that a couple times, and I don't think it's about like the fact that something should or shouldn't be bolted. I think it's totally fine to bolt. I think the bolt should be there if people want to do it that way. But I also don't think that the bolts being there should take away from other people who want to have a different experience on the route and do it on trad gear if it goes that way. So I just thought that was a fun challenge for the trip and really enjoyed the process of it.
So interesting to hear you say all of that, because that was the biggest fear with like ever adding a bolt, that, you know, that was like the big pushback, was like, you're going to ruin the experience for the future. You know, one day they'll come here and they won't need the bolts, and the experience will just be ruined for them. But you're kind of refuting
that. Here
you are. Here you are. And you're talking about a perfectly great experience that you had.
On climbs where it's like a very obvious crack, I don't think there should be bolts. I don't think anyone really debates that, but when it gets into like more marginal gear, I'm not going to like get mad over bolts being there or not and stuff like that. Like if it's marginal gear and people want to sport climb it and there's like the ability to get bolting permits there, I think that's totally fine. But I mean, I think some people would want like the trad experience, and I think that's, the bolts don't really take away from that.
So I read this line that, you know, you've showed up in Colorado. That was that a just a schooling decision, or also a location decision, or just a location decision as far as going to CU Boulder?
A lot of location. Some okay. school. I mean, I figured
there's
like,
a school there.
Yeah, I mean,
you're schooling.
Like, I figured any college would kind of be fine. I just kind of want to, like, I guess go to school, get a degree. But I mean, a lot of it was like, I really wanted to climb around here, and there's so much good trad climbing and adventurous big wall climbing even during the summer, like on the Diamond and in the Black, that I'm really stoked on doing. So it was a lot of location, partially school. There is a school here and it's pretty fun and good, and I have some friends going here, so it seemed like it would be the best option.
Yeah, so Will, I'm kind of curious to hear how you fit in with your other peers, not really at school, but just climbing wise, because you know, I look at your Instagram and like you said, you don't post all that much, and it's a very quick scroll to go back to when you're just like a little grommet climbing on Rat Rock, you know. So you, over the last I don't know, last 8-10 years or something, like you haven't posted that many photos, and it's kind of cool to see, you know, a very quick progression of you as going from this comp kid, this little kid, to doing these 514 track climbs. But, you know, a lot of people your age, I think, are, you know, quite heavily involved with social media and like are posting, really good at posting and doing all the whatever social media stuff. Do you feel like you fit in with the other climbers your age? You know, you're also doing this kind of more obscure type of climbing, relatively speaking. So just tell us a little bit about how you see yourself fitting in with your other climbers of your age.
Yeah, so I guess like a lot of people definitely are just like into bouldering, comp climbing, stuff like that. And I think that's great. Like, I mean, I like train with them all the time, like in gyms. Like that's most of the climbing I do, is like training in gyms. Like I'm not always outdoor trad climbing, because I think if I did that, I like wouldn't be able to maintain strength. So like most of the time I'm in the gym, like trying hard, and it's really fun, like hanging out with people who are just like really stoked on trying hard and like in gym climbing and stuff like that, and being able to train with them for the bigger things has been like really fun. But I've also been able to find like some trad partners. Like there's one kid on team who was like into it before. I have like two friends who are into like mountaineering and like psyched on belaying me on hard trad routes and like doing some combination of adventurous trad and like mountaineering type stuff in Rocky Mountain National Park. And just some people who I've like been able to like get stoked on it, like show them the videos, like isn't this cool, and then like try and convince them to go on trips with me. So, but like I definitely don't have, I guess, a ton of people who are like psyched on the same like level of hard trad climbing. It could potentially be dangerous. I've definitely spent a lot of time like top rope soloing some routes, just putting a lot of work in on it like that. And I think that's one of the best ways to work a climb. And then, like, I'll try and recruit some friends when it's, like, time to give the Sengo and have a Blair.
What about the social media part of it? Was that an unfair characterization I made about your generation being super online?
No, that's fair. I guess I'm not successful at it, but, like, I try and post when I can. And I don't know, maybe it's just, like, I'm always, like, trying to post something really cool. Like, I don't know if I just post some random everyday stuff, but when I do a cool climb, like, I do like to share it on social media. But then sometimes it's like, oh, if I do these three climbs, it'll be cool. And sometimes I don't, like, have the best photos. Like, yeah, I mean, that's a part of it. It's like, have the best photos to post, but
you're a little more discerning.
Maybe, yeah. I think, I don't know, I just, like, wait until I have some good photos or videos. And
you go for quality over quantity.
Yeah, something like that.
I hear you.
Well, speaking of quantity, I read some line where it said you were trying to do all the trad 14s in Colorado and you're basically almost done. But then even as someone who's lived in Colorado for, you know, a long time, I'll just say that, and climbed here a long time, I was like, how many are there? I don't even know. Like, so by your count, how many are there? Let me go back. Is this true? Is this a goal of yours?
This is definitely a goal. Okay. But the part where I'm almost done is not true.
Okay.
My big goal is I want to do it within the first year of moving here. And I've done two so far, Cheating Reality and Viceroy. Viceroy being the hardest and scariest one of them all, 14BR, which I don't know if you're familiar, but one of my favorite climbing films ever, Brad Gobright, broke his back on it.
That's right.
Yeah, so that made it scary. And that was one of the ones I was talking about where I put a lot of top rope soloing in before I gave a lead go, which I think was the best way to make it safe. But so, yeah, I mean, there's those two, which I've done already. There's Chinadol, which I put some work into and been pretty close on. Then there's one my friend put up in Gross Reservoir called, I don't even know what it's called, but it's like this short climb in Gross Reservoir. And then there's Orangutan Overhang and Independence Pass and Full Done West Bay Direct on the Diamond. And there used to be Iron Monkey, but a key hold on that broke and it hasn't been done since and would be really hard if it went, which I think it does go, but it'd be really hard. And it's not like one of the things that I'm like trying to do as one of the Trad 514s, which has like been done. But yeah, I mean, there's those six. So I did two in the fall. Hopefully I'm going to do two in the spring, which could be a lot because I'm also trying to go out to Indian Creek a bunch to learn how to like crack climb better, to prepare for my Yosemite trip right when school's over. But then after I get back from that Yosemite trip, I want to spend some time in the summer like working out Full Done West Bay Direct on the Diamond and hopefully also doing Orangutan Overhang. But it's definitely a hard goal, but I'm pretty psyched on it.
What's your date? I mean, sometime in September? What's at the end of the year?
Yeah, I mean, pretty much like that, sometime in December. Like, I guess probably before school starts is like when I'm psyched on doing before. Obviously, if I don't, I want to do them anyways because they're just sick climbs. But it just gave me like a nice goal to like get on all the really cool and fun trad routes in Colorado and just kind of allowed me to like kind of take advantage of like all the hard trad climbing that there is here. Because in the Gunks, I think like the leadable trad routes that had been done, I think it was like one 14A, but like here there's six of them in the state, which is just like crazy compared to the Gunks in New York and that area. So I was just like, felt like I need to take advantage of this and make like a really cool goal that I'm stoked on, and this just seemed like the one.
And just, you know, for personal interest, I think Andrew's interested in this as well, that you went out and repeated Hayden Kennedy's Kokanee Corner route on the Bridger Jacks. Also maybe for you, inspired by Brad, he put effort onto that and made a little movie about it. And so tell us about that. I mean, it's a little obscure, you know. I mean, you got to kind of be in the know out in the creek to even know that it's there and hasn't been done other than that film that Brad did. So yeah, tell us about not just climbing it, but what got you out there.
I mean, that film pretty much. I definitely am someone who like watches climbing films, gets stoked, and it's like, I want to do that. That looks sick. I guess I've done two creek trips where I'm like, I'm gonna go out there, get really good at crack climbing, and then I just end up kind of going there and working like the coolest looking climb and coolest climbing climb that ends up just being very sport style. But like, I definitely did have that as my goal. The second time I went there after watching that video, I was like, that can go. There's a dino. You can't reach the dino. I'm tall. And I just got really psyched after watching that film. But that was definitely an obscure climb. It was unlike any climb I had tried before. And it was really cool and interesting and different than all the climbs I had done before. Like, the first time I went up it, it just felt like really obscure and hard. Like, I got through the like boulder problem at the beginning, not flash, like took me a couple goes. I was like working stuff out, but then like the stemming sequence felt crazy. I was like kind of just aiding my way through it, kind of nervous on the triple zeros in sandstone, or I guess zero Z4, the modern cam, can be good. Like, they were good on Carbondale, but this crack definitely felt like a little more like sandy and dirty and not necessarily like the most ideal crack for small cams. But yeah, I mean, I was definitely a little nervous and worried going up it for the first time, kind of aiding it, and it just felt like pretty obscure. And then like the surprising thing that I found that like the GoBright video didn't even go over at all was after that like glory finger lock. It was like the classic, he like made it through the stemming sequence, like hung on the finger lock, and it kind of looked like it was over, and he just like kind of cruised through this layback sequence after. But for me, that was like a 0.2 crack, and I kind of have like fat fingers, so it was just like very thin to me. Like, I was like barely crimping anything, and I was also aiding my way through that. So like the first time I went up it, I like got to the top, I was like, there's no way I'm gonna be able to do that, like that's ridiculous. And then I was there with these two friends who were filming, and they were like, that was the first time I was able to set up the line, so they weren't really filming from above, and they were like, well, you gotta get back on to like, we'll get the film. And so instead of like placing gear again, I like left in pre-placed gear for that attempt. And I didn't make it through the bottom boulder. But then I had to go like from there, kind of like one hang attempt type of thing, where I made it like through the like first stemming sequence and then also through the second stemming sequence, which I was really surprised about because that felt like really impossible the first time. But it was such a weird style that I think once you know it, it like gets a little better. But then like fell on the 0.2 sequence because that just felt like ridiculously thin. But then I went back there again over Thanksgiving and kind of made that like the main goal for the trip. Like, the first day I was on it, I didn't really get through boulder sequence because I don't think I had the best beta, and it was also just like a really awkward style of climbing, like super thin. And after that, I kind of like realized the second day I wouldn't really be able to like do it because I was pretty tired. So we left a rope fixed where I was able to like top rope solo it a lot. And that was super helpful because I was able to like really dial down the sequences and kind of figure out the stemming sequence in a way that was more secure than I had done it last time, where I'd be able to place the gear on lead and all of that, as well as like better beta for the 0.2. Like, the beta I found there was that the only way I was really able to do it was by like scumming my lat into the right corner and like pressing off of these smear edges. And like barely even using the hands, just like bump my lat up a little bit, like squirm up, and then like barely walk the feet. And I kind of figured out that sequence. Never like linked that much on TR. Like, I tried to even link like from the stemming sequence through the 0.2s, but that didn't even go. Like, didn't really link the boulder, but then came down, got the rope. It was like raining, I think, that day. So we had to take like 2 or 3 rest days, let everything dry. But then when I came back, like, I somehow sent it the second go of the day. It was like really a fight, especially to get through that like lat scum 0.2 sequence. Like, a couple of footholds were like just like getting really sandy. And the thing about the creek is like, whenever you're climbing there, your shoes always get like a solid amount of like cake on them, like just sand. So just like a lot of the smear feet just felt really bad and insecure. But I like was barely able to make it through that. And then I ended up having a little more of an epic than expected on like the last pitch. Even it was definitely hadn't been climbed in a while, because even if you're working Kokanee, there's like, if you hadn't done the second pitch, there's no reason to like really do the last pitch. And it was this solid 512 finger crack that went into a 5.9 off with, and that thing was like so sandy and like kind of loose as well, it felt like. So I mean, the gear was like good and cracked, but I was like, I haven't like placed gear in a crack this sandy ever. So just like felt like a crazy experience. I like kind of barely got up and on the onsite after being so tired. But it was definitely a fight. I like had a foot pop one time where I was just like hanging. And then the 5.9 off with didn't really go as I expected either, because like in Mountain Project, they said that like a 6 would fit, but it kind of didn't, and it just ended up falling out of the crack and onto the rope. So I was on like, there was like a two bolt anchor there, but it was like a long ways to the top. But that was just like such a fun experience. It was the first desert tower I had ever climbed, and standing on top of it just felt so cool. It was just like you could see all around, like the 360 landscape. And it was just such a fun experience. And being able to do it on a climb that was that hard and engaging was just so fun. But yeah, I mean, that was a fun experience and like a really fun goal that I had that I was really psyched to do.
Does it top out on Sacred Space? Does it go into that same off with?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, I've climbed that thing.
Oh, nice. Yeah, I totally forgot how to off with. I kind of knew in the basic sizes. Yeah. Like the hand stacks, like the chicken wing, but
that's just like almost a squeeze chimney, you
know? Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah. But it was like kind of on that weird like level where it like wasn't quite, but it was like also kind of flared and like weird and stuff like that. But I got through it, it was fine. But it was like, I don't know, it was just like kind of a whole epic day. It was just like overall a really good time.
So it's cool to hear that you watching climbing films and are inspired by them, get goals from them and stuff. You haven't seen Free Solo, have you?
I have.
is that on the agenda as well? I'm just kidding. Yeah. So why don't you tell us a little bit about, like, you've mentioned this, you know, this goal of doing all the 514s in Colorado, but what else, what are your kind of bigger aspirations? Like what do you hope to do? And also I'd be interested to hear just like how, like who do you kind of look up to? Who are the climbers that you kind of want to follow in their footsteps?
Yeah, I mean, definitely like the Holland and Tommy, like the epic stuff they've done. Like, I mean, one of my big goals, I guess like a little longer term than most of the goals I have now, although like, I don't know, most of the goals I have are like pretty like, oh, just like the next thing I want to do. But definitely like watching the old film of Tommy, like freeing both the nose and free rider in a day, just like seems so epic. But I guess recently living here, like I've been watching a lot of videos of Gobright, and those were all really sick, got me inspired on a lot of things like Viceroy, Cheating Reality, and Kokanee Corner. But yeah, I mean, I guess those are the climbers I look up to. And as far as goals, like definitely want to free some hard routes like Magic Mushroom. And I guess one day Dawnwall is something I'd be really stoked on. And also just like freeing hard routes in a day. Like I love doing like really a bunch of hard climbing in a day. And just like hard routes on LCAP, just like seeing how far I can push that. But or like next coming up trip, I guess like the things I'm really stoked on are in Yosemite, I want to try and flash free rider and give my best flash go on Wet Like or Nightmare, which could be a stretch, definitely. If I don't get the flash, I want to try and do it within a day of being on it. Maybe have like a 24-hour epic on it, just like trying to see if I can free it within that time span of getting on it. But yeah, those are like the two things I'm really stoked on. Like I went there in last spring to I went there with my dad, wanted to try and flash free rider, but it was unlucky. It was like the biggest snowfall of the year, so the top third of LCAP was wet. I didn't just want to like get on it to just get shut down on wet stuff. So we ended up doing some other goals, which were really fun. On-sighted Astroman and Westie Face, which was really fun, like a 13A big wall. Super cool, right next to Wet Like or Nightmare. Very sports style, so something I was used to. But yeah, the whole trip was super fun, but definitely left me with some things I wanted to go back for, which is what I'm psyched on doing in this late spring, early summer. I mean, it's hard to tell with like flashing big walls. Like, it was such a fun experience last time in Yosemite. Like, just being up there for the first time, it's not like flashing a single pitch route where you can like read it from the bottom and like stand way out and kind of know what you're getting into. It was just like a much more adventurous feel, and it's something I'm really stoked on, but it's a little hard because it's also something quite unpredictable that like on a flash go, like any little thing could happen and it's all over. But I'm just really psyched on the goal of it, and hopefully I'm hoping for the best and hopefully they'll go.
Talking to you, I've been like chuckling under my breath over here out of like admiration and kind of joy, because I love when young climbers sort of, as I said, I think in a previous podcast with those guys who climb the nose, Billy and Alex. And I love when like you guys come in and sort of smash the state, like, you know, there's this dyed in the wool thought that, you know, you have to spend your time and learn how to place the gear and like, you know, work your way through all the things. And you just like happily didn't do that. And it wasn't any statement on your part. It was just out of sheer ability. It wasn't something that you needed to sort of waste your time leading 105.8s and 105.9s and 10s and 11s and everything else. So, I mean, do you have that feeling about like kind of treading into sacred ground and kind of breaking the rules? Or, I mean, are you aware of that kind of like context around what you're doing? Are you just going ahead with what feels right to you and not caring? And also, I mean, do you get any pushback from the trad dads at all on kind of some of those points?
Yeah, so I think that's an interesting point. Like, I definitely, like, no, I was told, like, oh, a lot of people, like, do 100 mock leads and all this, and then they, like, do a bunch of 5.8s and 5.9s. And I was like, well, that doesn't really make sense to me, because I get that it, like, might work for some people, but I'm like, if you're only taking out gear and you're doing it for a really long time, you don't really understand how it goes in, and if you're never falling on gear ever, you're not really understanding if it's good or not. So I'm like, well, if I'm really ready to trad lead, like, I should be ready to fall on my gear. Like, and once I got to that point where I was ready to trad lead, like, I was ready to fall on my gear. And then when I did fall on my gear, it, like, wasn't a big deal. And, like, the grades didn't really matter so much to me. It was more like, oh, I can place trad gear. Like, I can fall. When I took my falls, like, I definitely worked up a little bit, but I think it was a little faster because I, like, trusted my trad gear. And I know, like, a ton of people will go, like, so far trad climbing and like never taking one fall, and I was just like, well, that doesn't make sense. That just sounds like free soloing to me. Like, if I'm gonna trad climb, like, I should learn to like trust my gear and like make it really good. And once I got to that point of trusting my gear, it's like, well, there's no reason to not try hard things if I trust my gear. And that's what I did, and I fell, and it all worked out. But yeah, I mean, I think for me it was just like more of like my own logical perspective, at least logical in my view, where I was like, I should get to the point of trusting this. And then, like, once I do trust it, like, it makes sense to fall. And there's, like, not really anything else that would make more sense. Like, I don't think, like, getting on another 105.10s would, like, make any sense. It's like, well, if I can fall, I should, like, take the ability that I have and, like, just try some hard stuff. And if I fall, I fall. And it's fine.
That's such a refreshing answer. I love hearing that. It's like, so it makes so much sense, too. And it's a perspective that's just rarely hear, because people do have that old mentality. So that was great.
The cool thing about trad climbing, and another draw that it has to me, is that it like opens the door to so many other things, like big wall and adventure climbing. Like, you can't really climb LCAP if you don't know how to place trad gear, because there are just going to be certain pitches where you have to place trad gear on either easy or hard crack climbing and stuff like that. And like, doing this just seems like, even though it is cool and I love it in itself, like, I definitely want to do some big things one day. And to be able to do that, you have to know how to trad climb and know how to trad climb hard and deal with all these things that I'm figuring out single pitch, and definitely want to take to the multi-pitch and also allow a bunch of adventure climbing. Like, The Cuddle is like a recent film that also got me really stoked, and that's like something I would love to do one day. But it just like opens so many more doors than like, oh, you can only do the things that like someone has bolted, or you can spend a bunch of time bolted. It's like, well, yeah, but trad climbing like just opens a lot more doors and allows you to do cool, big adventure climbing.
So what about the grumps? Get any pushback that you're not supposed to be that climbing that hard yet, son?
Yeah, I think there was just like one guy who I was like talking. I don't know. He was like, I think he was like on a 5.9 and we were like gonna rappel next to it, and I was like, what's the name of this climb? Or I think he like talked to me first. He was like, oh, you're the guy who's here to try the project. And I was like, I guess I'm kind of just a kid who lives in New York City who wants to try it, but sure. And then I was like, oh, what's this climb again? And he was like, No Glow. And I was like, oh, okay. And he's like, so you just skipped all the classics? And I was like, well, not really. I like did a lot of fun climbs, but I didn't do every single classic that ever existed.
You're 19.
Like, it was called
years
like,
old. No.
And it's a little weird that I didn't do that one. I don't know why, but I just done a lot of other really cool routes. Like, there's so many good ones in the Gunks. It's like hard to do every single good 5.9 before wanting to try harder. So I guess that was a little pushback, but I didn't really get anything that big.
I mean, you were probably younger than that, 19 then, right? Probably like
17. Yeah, I mean, I was like 16. He's like,
you got plenty of time to do the classics, dog.
Yeah. Like, this, but I mean, that's a classic, but like, look at Ozone. Like, that looks so cool.
Yeah, so we lament that we're very disconnected with the youth over here. But I do have a question for you. Do you ever use the phrase day flash?
No.
Okay.
I don't know. It's kind of silly.
Awesome.
It's
I appreciate
like, it. Projecting it for years, and then the freshest I am, I send it. It's like, well, that doesn't make any sense. On a flex.
Thank
the kids
you.
Are going to be all
Thank
right.
You, Will Moss.
I think that's the my yep, takeaway from this episode.
Yep, the kids are all right. Hey, folks. Do you absolutely love every word you hear on the Runout? Agree with everything we say? And do you think we understand climbing better than you? Wait, did you just say yes? Well, then we're not doing our job. You see, we want the Runout to be just like the name implies. A little risky, not for everybody all the time, but damn satisfying when we don't crater. We love it when you disagree, call out our bullshit, but are entertained nonetheless. No other climbing media has quite the same attitude. So we'd love for you to join our community and support what we're doing by becoming a rope gun at patreon.com/runoutpodcast. We can't do this without you. And if we do end up needing sponsors, well, we'd likely have to cut back on the dildo jokes, the cackling, and the controversial opinions. And you don't want that, do you? As a rope gun, you also get bonus material, have more of a say in what we say, and you keep this thing alive and independent. So join today at patreon.com/runoutpodcast.
For today's final bit, we're honored to feature the atmospheric music of climber and musician Jessica Kilroy with her track, It's Infinite.
Ground, this is a high ground, a higher ground, a higher ground, this is a
just listened to another episode of the Run Out Podcast. If you like our show, the best way to support us is by giving us money. We don't care about iTunes ratings. You can share it with your friends or don't, whatever. But we are 100% listener supported because we believe this is the best way to stay independent, say what we think, and be accountable to the most important people in our lives, which is you, our listeners. To support our show, check us out on Patreon. It's patreon.com/runoutpodcast. For as little as $5.14 a month, you can become part of the Runout Nation and get bonus episodes that will titillate your ear holes. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next episode.